Welcome to another edition of Five of the Best. This one is going to be about 1988. This one is going to be a short one. This is a hobby podcast, and it has been a bank holiday over here, and we've had nice weather for a change. I'm going to start off with the Mike Tyson, and he's a year he's not ever going to forget, I don't think. It started oh so brightly with beating Larry Holmes. The great Larry Holmes in four rounds, although an aging boxer. He beat Larry Holmes, and then went on 2 months later, he went on to beat a fat Tony Tubbs. Tony Tubbs was offered £50,000 or dollars to lose £30, which he did, in fact. And he beat Tony Tubbs in two rounds. And in April that year, he went on and married. He married Robin Gibbs, the actress Robin Gibbs, and things started to unravel very quickly after that. In June, he assaulted a TV crew, and in July, he was actually seen helping for entering a psychiatrist for mental problems. This inevitably led to the TV appearance with him and Robin Gibbs saying that everything was all right. And then 2 weeks later, Robin Gibbs sues Mike Tyson for defamation and libel for $125 million. They sue for divorce, he countersues. This all happens when Mike Tyson is at the peak of his career and in the media spotlight all the time. And really, there are people there who really didn't have Mike Tyson's interests at heart. And just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, Donald Trump then bills Mike Tyson for $2 million for advisory counselling service. If I was Mike Tyson, I'd be suing him. Sandra Miller then sues for sexual harassment. I don't think he went to prison. I think he had a large payout for that. But it's a year he'd likely to forget, I think, in the end. He did have another fight, in fact. He fought Michael Spinks, another great boxer, and he beat him. So. But all in all, I think it's a year he'll likely to forget. I've seen interviews with Mike Tyson, and he can be very charming at times. There's a definite dark side to him. He's now been married to his long-term girlfriend for over 4 years now, and hopefully there'll be just nothing but good news from Mike Tyson. In 1988, it sounds like a hot year, because in Cleveland, I don't know where that is, there is a record temperature of 104 Fahrenheit. There was also some big movies released in 1988, and there was a Die Hard opened and in 1988 with Bruce Willis, and that was made for $28 million and made $140 million. And one of my favourite films, Big, with Tom Hanks, was made, and that was made for $18 million and had a box office of $151 million. And also Beetlejuice, which was made for $16 million and that made $120 million. One last summary of 1988. The last Playboy club closed, and that they were basically replaced by titty bars. We don't have titty bars in the UK. I don't know what they are. I don't know if they're strip clubs. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. Anyway. There'll be pictures of the articles on Five of the Best at Podomatic.com. In 1988, we saw the unveiling of the new stealth bomber, or B2. This was a revolutionary new design, because basically it is just a flying wing, and for years aeronautics have dreamt of the idea of a flying wing being the perfect aircraft, doing away with fuselage and tails and engine casings, which always cause drag. It's not a new idea. The Horton brothers in the 1920s and early 30s were designing a flying wing for the Nazi party. In fact, the Horton H09 is the first prototype made of the flying wing, although it never flew. By 1944, the Horton brothers had redesigned the HO9 and come up with the H229. And this was built and tested. It was a jet plane powered by the Junkers jet engine, and it was tested against the other jet engine of the time, the Messerschmitt 262, and it easily outperformed it in the speed test it had. And unfortunately, this plane crashed on landing, and it was destroyed. And with the war ending, that meant. It seemed to be the end of the Flying Wings story. But in America, a guy called Jack Northrop had also been experimenting with Flying Wings. And in 1946, he built the XP-35, which is a Flying Wing with four turboprop engines. And this plane looks fantastic. You got to have a look at it on the website. It did everything the Americans wanted to, but with a cruise speed of just 180 miles an hour, The Americans just said no, it was too slow and scrapped it. Not to be undone, Jack Northrop went back to the drawing board and designed the XP-49, which had 8 jet engines and had a cruise speed of 500 miles an hour and a ceiling of 40,000 feet. Both the XP-35 and the YB-49 had a wingspan of about 60 meters, so these were big planes. And the XB went had tests with the Air Force, but it was incredibly difficult to fly. This was without the aid of computers, of course, and it was very unstable. And with this, the US government then ordered the destruction of all 10 of the YB-45 fleet. That was the end of the story for the Flying Wing for the next 35 years, until the 1980s, when the Americans wanted a new undetectable heavy bomber, and it was in fact Northrop which won the contract with its B-2 bomb. The design of the plane, being so unusual, had leaked out, and you could actually buy IFX models of it, and it was appeared on Kellogg's cornflakes and stuff. But on the 24th of October, November 1988, Northrop unveiled the plane with a wingspan of 54 meters and powered by four jets, producing 19,000 pounds of thrust. But, its cruise speed was 560 and a ceiling height of 40,000 feet. The plane carries no flares or chaff or defense missiles. It relies solely on its stealth capability, and the plane is made from carbon fiber, and it's also painted on paint radar absorbent materials, and on board there's over 100 computers which also aid computers for radar jamming. Originally the US government was going to purchase 121 of these aircraft, but reduced that down to 21 for a variety of reasons. The main reason being that the USSR, the main threat at the time, was being broken up, and actually the price of the aircraft, which was nearly £1 billion an aircraft, but that was reduced to a mere snip of its present value of $760 million. The maintenance of the aircraft, all the technology, has made it incredibly expensive to maintain. It is in fact three times more costly than a B-52 to maintain a year. And typically a B-52 for 1 hour's flight requires 60 hours maintenance. But for a B-2 for 1 hour's flight, it requires 119 hours of maintenance. Of the original 21 aircraft which were built, only 20 survived because of one crash which happened in 2008 in Guam, when it crashed while trying to take off. I still think that this will be one of the most iconic aircraft in the future, and I can't see them being replaced, especially at $760 million a piece. In 1988, the Turin Shroud was carbon dated, and this was hoped to put the rest of the question of how old the Turin Shroud was. And the carbon dating found out that it was in fact a medieval garment. fact, this wasn't the first time that the Turin Shroud had been tested. To get access to the Turin Shroud has always been a struggle. And in 1978, scientists were allowed to have access to the Turin Shroud for 5 days, although they were not allowed, they could not actually cut pieces off. They could just photograph all sorts of. They were just allowed to photograph the piece, and they used infrared and ultraviolet photography. They were also looking for pigments to see if, in fact, it was a painted-on piece or some sort of print. And at the end of their findings, they found that it was not a printed piece. In fact, they actually found bits of blood which were invisible to the human eye. And they come to the conclusion that the Turin Shroud was of a tortured and a crucified man, although they doubted whether it was Jesus Christ. They had no idea how the Turin Shroud was made, and they tried to various techniques to recreate the image, but they couldn't. And in fact, the image of the Turin Shroud is in fact a negative. A picture negative of the Turin Shroud, and that was taken in 1931. In fact, the history of the Turin Shroud is as mysterious as the Turin Shroud. The first recorded viewing of the Turin Shroud was in 1300 in a little village in France of Loret, and in 1536 it was almost destroyed by fire, and it has water damage. In fact, you can still see the burn marks in the Turin Shroud. And after this, when it was ever on display, it had general wear and tear because people just were touching it. And it was in this by then, by 1578, the church took it to Turin for safekeeping, where it remains today. In 1988, it was really thanks to John Paul II who allowed scientists to come in and do the carbon dating, which meant that a 2-inch piece of the Turin Shroud was cut from the shroud, and that piece was cut into four and sent to four labs around the world for carbon dating. The way that carbon dating works is the shroud is burnt, and the smoke it produces is then captured, and the number of atoms within that smoke can then derive the age of the shroud to around 30 years. When the carbon dating came back from the various labs, there wasn't the common consensus of a 30-year age variance. There was in fact a 165-year variance between the different samples. Although this surprised the scientists, they still concluded that this was a medieval material, and that should be put the age to bed. And this was so until a couple of years later, when two Americans saw pictures of the shroud, and they saw something which no one else saw. They saw the fact that the shroud had been French weaved, which was a type of repair in which the shroud's individual threads is then unraveled, and then the new thread interweaved with the old thread, and then two pieces then put together. This has been excellently done, but they took pictures of the Turin Shroud and showed it to textile manufacturers without telling them that it was from the Turin Shroud, and all five of them have said that yes, it is definitely French weaved. And if the scientists had looked at the pictures in which they took in 1978, they would have seen that the piece which they have cut from all the infrared and the ultraviolet tests, showing that the corner they cut from is a very different piece to the main body. The four labs which did the original carbon test had still had a secondary piece left over, and they did further tests, and they announced that the carbon dating cannot be an accurate age of the main body of the shroud. So that leaves the age question: is it real or not? They still cannot reproduce the 3D image which appears on the shroud. Even in today's technology, they don't know how that's done. Sport in 1988. I'm going to start off with Formula One. This was the 39th season of the Formula One, and this would be the last year in which we would see turbocharged engines, and there would be new points scoring system, which only the top 11 races would actually score you points. And the season would be dominated by two drivers. There would be Alain Prost, the two-time world champion, and the new guy to the team, Ayrton Senna. And there'd be some rivalry with the two drivers, with Ayrton Senna saying that Prost is the number one guy, and yet he goes on and races him almost every race. The season started with Ayrton Senna winning the first four races, and then they sort of alternatively did won the races throughout the season. The point system was a drawback, especially for Alain Prost. Alain Prost came in his 12th race, he came second, and he already had 84 points. And after coming second, he still had 84 points. And this was the scoring system was a detriment to the championship itself, and a competitive system, because in the very last race, Ayrton Senna was 3 points in the lead, but he didn't even have to race that last race and to win the championship. And really, Ayrton Senna won the world championship, but in fact, Alain Prost outscored Ayrton Senna by 12 points through the season. So, needless to say that the point system were dropped the following year, and also the turbos were stopped. I mean, the McLarens were so far ahead. I mean, in the Mexico Grand Prix, they lapped everyone up to third place, and the smaller teams just couldn't compete. The best non-aspirated car was a Williams, and that finished second in a wet British Grand Prix. Some of the other headlines, sporting headlines of the year, another guy who was very good at driving around in circles, Bill Elliott, was NASCAR champion. In a tennis, the Swedish got a grand slam. They won all the men's singles, with Mats Wilander winning, the Australian, the French, missing Stefan Edberg winning Wimbledon, and Mats Wilander winning his last and only, his last Grand Slam in the American Open. Steffi Graf wins everything, including the Olympics. In ice hockey, Wayne Gretzky goes to the LA Kings. He also becomes the leading scorer. And that's it.